All right, here we are. This is exciting. What we're going to talk about today is oneness part two. The whole theme of all these talks is on oneness. And so today, we're going to talk about a second stage of what we talked about last night. And because we're going to talk about some things that are touchy regarding race and ethnicity, I want to say a couple things up front. Please understand. A couple things here. One, there's a good chance that I'm going to say some things that are culturally not kosher. But I want to say the reason I believe what I believe and the reason I am suggesting the things I suggest or pointing out the things I'm even pointing out and observing is because they come from God. And I am the kind of person that I give everything over to the Lord. My thoughts, my heart, my desires, the way I choose to live my life. I want to give it over to God. And He has given us some written down things that are unchangeable. Written down so that they cannot be confused. Written down in frozen languages that won't ever change. They weren't written in English, and English is always changing. They're written in a form of Hebrew that is frozen. What's what they call a dead language. That means a dead language is one that doesn't change anymore. People don't speak it anymore. It is locked in. So the definitions of those words are permanent. It's not a word that, like we have some words that are in the King James Bible that I don't feel comfortable saying in everyday communication. That's because English has changed and definitions have changed. Hebrew hasn't changed. And the form of Greek that was used in the first century to write the New Testament, called Koine Greek, is a dead language. There are similarities in alphabet, in words, and definition to today's Greek, but it's a different language entirely. It's a dead language, which means that is also frozen. Also Aramaic. Part of the Bible was written in Aramaic. The reason I say that is because I want you to know from the beginning that my faith is in God's Word. And people say, oh, well, the Bible has been translated all these many times, and all the translations, you lose something. No, it hasn't been translated a million different times into what we have today. It's been translated once from the original language into whatever language you want to translate it into. And that's because it's a dead language. So that's the first thing I want you to know, is I give my heart and my mind and my will over completely to God. The second thing I want you to know is that I'm going to be quoting some people, or I'm going to be saying some things that are a part of our historical reality in our country. And because I'm quoting people, saying things that are not nice, there may be some words or phrases that may strike you as a bit uncomfortable for somebody to speak in today's day and age. I'm not trying to offend anybody. I'm not trying to be bombastic. I'm merely reading quotes. And in my judgment, I'm not going to say anything or read anything that won't, that will cause undue stress. But looking at the reality of our history and our country, I think you'll understand the context in which these things were said. And so, because we have a lot to go over today, this lesson will probably be the longest one I do all weekend. I'm not apologizing for that. I just want you to know, there's no shame if you have to get up and go to the bathroom or anything. This is being recorded. If you have to go. But I'm just telling you that up front. I normally would never do that, but I just thought I would today. Turn with me to John chapter 17. If you were here last night, you know that what Jesus prayed for in his last moments as a free man, before he's taken captive and killed, is he prayed for all kinds of great things. One of the things he prayed for is the oneness of his disciples eternally. Why would he want his disciples to be unified and to be one on earth? Because they're going to be one in heaven. And that's what we pray for. Jesus taught us in Matthew 6 to pray for God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing. He's praying for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven, because God's will is that all of Jesus' disciples are one in Him forever. What kind of sense does it make? Oh, we'll be together in heaven, but we can't be together on earth. That's not biblical. So, but it does require a great amount of personal character and growth regarding love and forgiveness, the ministry of reconciliation that we're all supposed to be a part of according to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So anyway, we're in John 17. I want to read this for you. It says, verse 20, it reads, I do not ask on behalf of these alone, but for these also who believe in me through their word, that they may be one. Even as you, Father, are in me, and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them, and you in me, and that they may be perfected in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me, and love them even as you have loved me. There are things I said about this passage last night I'm not going to say today. Go listen to the talk if you weren't here. There's things I'm going to say today. I want you to think about this. He says, I've given them my glory. I've given them the glory which you've given me. I've given to them. It's my glory. You've given it to me, but I've given it to them. Why? That they may be one. This is we are one. What is the simplest, most universal statement about how we are saved? I want you to how we're all sinners. I want you to think about it. It's the most famous one we use because it's so perfectly stated is Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and fallen short of what? The glory of God. If we are created in the image of God, we are supposed to be looking like God. And part of what it means to look like God is to have God's glory. So the glory that Jesus gave us is so that we can be united. And yet, like we said last night, Christians have made a very good business at slicing and dicing the body of Christ. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 3 goes in detail about how God is giving us His glory back. Us sinners who are saved, reclaimed, and redeemed by God, He's giving us His glory back. So that people, when they see us, they will see God's glory. And part of how they see God's glory is when His disciples are one. That is the output of what Jesus already did. Well, I can't be... Listen, don't think about what you can or can't do. Jesus gave us the glory God gave Him so that we can be one. You're going to say Jesus didn't give us what we need to be one? He absolutely did. Because He said so in His prayer to the Father. So, why still in this day and age are there churches that are divided by skin color, even though they're blocks apart? You may not have seen that reality. I have. And they seem content with that. And it may be some apparently natural byproduct of times gone by. But not always, because some of those congregations are new. And I know preachers who have been supported financially to come to a city to start a quote-unquote black church. Why would that happen in this day and age with among Christians who are trying to follow the Bible and they read John 17? So I want to suggest, a lot of people will use race as a basis to divide us. And the most foundational question that a lot of people ask, in my opinion, is this question here: if the Adam and Eve story is true, why are there so many races? This has been sort of a pet topic of mine since even before I was a Christian. And my stepmother told me she believed, see, she saw all the races and thought, well, there must have been an Adam and Eve for every race. How many of you have heard someone say that? Seriously, no one's ever heard that? There you go, people have heard that. There's all kinds of, we look at our reality of how we talk about race. And we make up all kinds of reasons for why that exists. One of the most popular ones that Christians will even ascribe to is that races came about because of evolution. And I'm going to show you today that that is not true. And that is not, there's no way, based on the Bible and based on science, even based on common sense. you can say that the racial categories we have today came about because of evolution. And I used to believe that. I used to believe, you know, people that were Scandinavian had long noses to warm the snow, to warm the cold air up before it got to their lungs. They had long hair to keep them warm. And people around the equator in Africa had thick curly hair to block the sun, and they had wider nostrils because the air was more dense and humid, darker skin to protect from the sun, that kind of thing. But the reason we know that's not true is because in the same climate as the Scandinavians are the Inuit Indians, who are dark, some many darker, much darker than me, with wide nostrils and short, squatty body. Why do they have wide nostrils, and why do they have dark skin? And why do the people living at the equator in our hemisphere, the Western hemisphere, not have thick, curly hair? They have straight, limp hair. And some of whom are not any darker than me. Maybe. So why is that reality? They do have long noses, not around the heat. Why do they have long noses when the air isn't cold to warm up? See, and I just want to throw that out there. I'm going to give you the reason we have our racial categories today. And the reason they are propagated and continue to be bandied about. And when you realize after today, when you realize the number that has been done on us as a people, as human beings, and especially as Christians, it's almost laughable if it wasn't so sad. It's almost embarrassing. But you will never be ignorant ever again. And after today, I promise you, you will never see things the same way again. Because nobody talks this way in our culture, not even our brethren, that I've heard. I'm sure some do somewhere, but that I've heard. So there's three reasons. I want to say power and politics. I kind of combine those. Power and politics, prejudice, and the pernicious one. That's Satan. So I wanted another P for Satan, but I didn't have one. There's no other name I found for Satan starting with P. But pernicious does occur once in the New King James New Testament. So, and it means evil. So I just apply that to Satan. So the pernicious one. That's why we have racial categories today. Power in politics, prejudice, and the pernicious one. So let's just back up and look a little bit at our history in America at racial categories. And just to give you some perspective, not even looking at today, but in 1990 in the census, Americans filled out categories for over 300 races or ethnic groups. In 1990, there were over 600 quote-unquote American Indian tribes and over 70 categories of different types of what would be called Hispanic. So let's just look at our history and see what our country has shown. In the first 100 years of our country, there were three racial categories in the census. White, black, and Indian. And you have to wonder, why was it so important to count people who weren't considered citizens or who couldn't vote? Because you had to have the power. Because if you counted the people, even if they were only two-thirds of a citizen, then you had more votes in Congress. You could have more representatives. And you have more power in the political realm. So that's why they were counting those people that couldn't even vote. But anyway, first 100 years. So you look at the trajectories of Asian and Pacific Islander and Hispanic. It's very interesting. In 1870, after roughly 100 years of our country, we had one more color added to the census categories. The fourth one that was now added was Chinese. Chinese was a new color. In 1890, Japanese is added as a race or color. In 1920, they added three more races or colors. And those were Filipino, Korean, and Hindu. If you don't know, Hindu is a religion. Just so you know. All right. So they all kind of got, in 1977, the government came up with a plan, and they lumped them all together in what was called Asian and Pacific Islander. So then you have the trajectory of what we call Hispanics. And by the way, there was a recent, all the studies, all the polls of people who would be considered Hispanic, there's always more than 50% of them that don't like the term Hispanic. It's really, politics created that term in the 70s. I'm not going to get into why, but there were some political people who were trying to create a voting bloc in response to what they saw as an African-American voting bloc. So, hey, they all speak Spanish. Let's put them together. They'll vote for us. And so it's kind of like that. That's a gross simplification, but that's very much what happened. So in 1930, Mexican was added as a race. But here's what's interesting. After Mexican got added as a race, there was a big loud outcry, and then by the next census, Mexican was taken off as a race. That's interesting. And you notice some of these Hindus not still on there as a racial category. But it was taken off right away because people didn't like it as a race. I'm not going to get into why. And then in 1977, the same movement created Hispanic as a racial category. But I will observe this. The same time frame in the 70s, there was a book called USA by the Numbers. There were only three racial categories, but there were only two racial categories in the abortion section. Isn't that interesting? White and non-white. So basically, nobody can agree on how many races there are. Nobody can. You might be thinking, how many races are there? I told you in 1990 we had over 300 on our census form. 300. I want to suggest not just power in politics, but prejudice is what keeps these racial categories going. And part of that prejudice came from Darwinian evolution. I'm not saying it started there, but a famous evolutionist, Darwinian evolutionist, Stephen Jay Gould from Harvard said this, that biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1850, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory. He's saying people used biology as a reason to justify these racial categories and racism. Now here's the question. The categories for race that we are most familiar with still connect back to a guy in the 1700s named Carolus Linnaeus, who was a taxonomist. He was very famous for categorizing animals in genus and species. And he categorized human beings into four different categories. He called them the white race, which were Europeans. He called them the red race, which were the Native Americans. The dark race, which were the Southeast Asians, and the black race. And here's what he said about them. By the way, in 1940, the Native Americans and the Southeast Asians got lumped together, and they became the red race. So then you had three. And a lot of people here are familiar with three main racial categories. How many of you were taught there were three main racial categories? Are you guys not like a hand-raising kind of church? I don't know, maybe not, that's not that common. Maybe you guys weren't taught about the Caucasoid, the Mongoloid, and the Negroid, and all that stuff. Anyway, but here's what he said about these categories. He said Native Americans were ruled by custom. Africans were indolent and negligent. The Europeans, the white race, were inventive and gentle. Guess which one he was. So that has dominated our thinking in a long time. Well, here's the question. How can biology and genetics be used to justify concepts that were created in the 1700s when the study of genetics wasn't even around then? We didn't have the capacity to study human origins in the 1700s the way we do now. We didn't have the Human Genome Project like we do now. And yet we're using these things to justify concepts that were created in the 1700s. Something's a bit off. So because of the damage of evolutionary thinking propagated by Darwin mostly, his type of thinking, it impacted a lot of people negatively, and there was a lot of damage and fallout from that. Primarily for us, some of the damage, Hitler was greatly influenced by Darwin. I'm curious. How many of you know the name of Darwin's most famous book? Raise your hand if you know the name of his most famous book. The Origin of Species. Who's heard of that book? Raise your hand if you know the full name of the book. Seriously, please raise your hand if you know the name of it. Does anybody know the full name of the book? The Origin of Species. No one knows? Because it's not politically correct. You want to know why he poured gasoline on the flames of racism? Because that book's full title was The Origin of Species and the Preservation of Favored Races. They just took the name off because it doesn't make him look good. That's why one of his great pupils, Margaret Sanger, who created, a lot of you know she's famous for creating Planned Parenthood, but she also created what was called the American Birth Control League. Long before Planned Parenthood, you may not know it, but birth control was a thing that you couldn't even mail birth control in the mail. I mean, which meant you couldn't order it by catalog. There were a lot of laws against it. But she was popular, and she was a very primary person usually to create birth control being legal and popular, given out to people, and abortion. And here's why. She was a racist. I'm not saying Darwin was a complete racist, but Margaret Sanger was. And she created what's called the Negro Project. How many of you know what the Negro Project is? It was used to sterilize unknowing African-American women and other people that she deemed undesirables of society. Here's a quote. She said, colored people are like human weeds and are to be exterminated. That's why before Planned Parenthood and abortion came out, she was going to all the African-American preachers and giving them birth control and telling them to give it to their people because it'd be easier to raise kids, they wouldn't be as poor, and that way they could have less African-Americans. And it wasn't until the preachers started giving it to them that they were accepting of it. You might not have to think too hard to wonder why in 1930s America, given recent history with people that were still alive that were slaves, why you might not jump at the chance when somebody of a fairer complexion comes to you and says, hey, I got something to make you not have kids. You might not have to think too hard to why they were skeptical. And that's why it wasn't until their preachers gave it to them that they started accepting it. And she also said there are too many Negroes born yearly. She also wanted licenses for women to have. You had to get a license to become a mother, which is exactly, not quite exactly, but almost exactly what Hillary Clinton was saying in 1993, that you had to get certified to become a parent, to become a mom. If you don't, some people, you might think, yeah, that is good. I don't think you should have just whatever. Okay, let me say, just because our culture has gotten a little more sinful in the way we create children and raise children does not mean we give up God's authority for parents and give it to the government. If the government is the one who says who can have a baby or not, what happens when the person in charge in the government is somebody you don't like? And they may not have any self-restraint. I'm telling you, that's a dangerous place to go. So by creating the American Birth Control League and Planned Parenthood, her specific purpose was, quote, this is a quote, to create a race of thoroughbreds. This is not crazy stuff from long ago. We have a sitting Supreme Court justice who was appointed by Bill Clinton, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. After Obama was elected president in 2009, in July 2nd, 2009, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in talking about the cultural landscape of Roe versus Wade, the law that, the decision that made it legal for anybody to have an abortion, she said this, "Frankly, I had thought that at the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of." She knew because she's one of them. How does God feel about this? I just want you to think about that. How does God feel about that? I don't care about your political leanings. How does God feel about it? Douglas Wallace, who's been at all the top Ivy League schools, Emory, and all, he's now at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a geneticist and an evolutionary biologist. And he also was a pioneer in the use of human mitochondrial DNA as a molecular marker. This guy knows his stuff about genetics. And he's talking about race. You know what he says about our racial constructs we use in our culture? He said, the criteria that people use for race are based entirely on external features that we are programmed to recognize. Because they're not legitimate, is what he's saying. You go on and read the rest. They're not legitimate. Everybody knows that. That's in that world. Let me ask you this. How many of you, when you were a child and playing with crayons, or when you were an adult playing with crayons, whatever, but I say child because you heard people saying, oh, you're white, black, this and that, and you grab the black crayon and the white crayon and you realize something's not right. How many of you ever had that experience? Look at that. People, it happens as a child. And I remember thinking to myself, I had to really work to figure out how to draw somebody. And then because I was a know-it-all, somebody would say something about being white. And I said, you're not white. I grabbed the crayon and said, you're peach. And so that was me. Ashley Montague, who was a world-famous anthropologist in the 40s, in the 1940s, said that race is our most dangerous myth. C. Loring Brace, who's a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, and he's also the curator of the biological anthropology at the University of Michigan's Museum of Anthropology, he was talking about race and said that all of our characteristics for race are entirely arbitrary. He said, if I could control how we categorize race, he would categorize race this way. By chromosome 11. He said, if we could see inside and see the chromosome 11. He would, and that's the gene for hemoglobin. And then there'd be two races of human beings. There'd be, the Africans that live around the equator, the Greeks and the Italians would be one race, and that would be the sickle cell race. Then there'd be the Africans that, are the Xhosas, which is Nelson Mandela's ethnic group, his ethnic group, and the Scandinavians, like the Swedes and the Norwegians, they'd be in a different race. The healthy hemoglobin race. He was just making the point. One anthropologist said, the epicanthic eye folds, which we associate with Southeast Asian eyes, that would be the defining category. And then you'd have people in Japan and China, and the Kung San, which are the Bushmans that talk like with the clicks. The Bushmen and the Japanese and Chinese would be one race, everybody else would be the other race. Because it's all about arbitrary physical characteristics that we have been trained to recognize. And another anthropologist, the Dean of Natural Science at Hampshire College, Alan Goodman, said, depending on how you divide race genetically, you won't get, he's saying, like with the epicanthic eye folds, legitimate genetic differences in people, or the hemoglobin, chromosome 11. But depending on how you divide people genetically into race, here's what he said, quote, you won't get anything that remotely tracks conventional racial categories. He's saying how we look at race, white, black, yellow, whatever, that there's no way to support those racial categories in any way genetically. I have so much on this, but I'll say this real quick. To go to our culture, the American Anthropological Association has been trying to get rid of these racial categories for generations, for a long time. In 1996, they offered to the government a statement on race. You can read it, but part of it, let me read to you part of this right here, the statement on race. In the United States, both scholars and the general public have been conditioned to viewing human races, the racial categories, as natural and separate divisions within the human species based on very visible physical differences. Watch this. See, those categories were created before we had the science we have now. And this is what they say. With the vast expansion, this is in the 90s they made this statement. With the vast expansion of scientific knowledge in this century, however, it has become clear that human populations are not unambiguous, clearly demarcated, biologically distinct groups. What he's saying is, they are ambiguous. Here's what he means. If you walk from one side of Europe to the other, you will see slight variations in human beings and their appearance. So slight, you wouldn't think of categorizing them. That would happen anywhere you start walking in the world, except for America or with the modern travel we have now. But 200 years ago, that's what would happen. So why do we have the categories that Carolus Linnaeus came up with? It's the trade routes. When you're from Europe and you go to China, stark contrast. You're from Europe and you sail to West Africa, stark contrast. Such a stark contrast that you might even be inclined to categorize the people to make sure that there's such a strong difference that you might be able to exercise a little power in politics and maybe create a whole industry by treating people as animals. Chattel slavery, which is a far cry from the slavery in the Old Testament. Or we see in the New Testament. Far different. It's the trade routes. And we as the church, when we talk about race, we have got to go to the Bible. Don't be afraid to trust the Bible. Even when it comes to science, and people say, oh, the Bible doesn't talk about science. Let me just give you one thing that's really interesting that's made a lot of people look embarrassed. 100 years ago, archaeologists mocked the Bible. And they said that there was no such thing as a Hittite nation. We see all, the Hittites are mentioned in the Old Testament. And they say, we see all the other nations in archaeology right next to where we, in the same ones that are listed with the Hittites, but the Hittites, we don't find anything about the Hittites. This is 100 years ago. So it obviously was made up, and they were just observing, and maybe they made up the Hittite people in the Bible. So the Bible is not only not true, it's certainly not inspired by God, even if there were a God. Well, lo and behold, today, you can get a PhD in Hittiteology. Just want to tell you. But I will say, a lot of Christians have absorbed the culture. It's hard to rub the culture off. It's hard to look at the world as anything different than what it was when you grew up. Let me read to you something out of a science textbook that started in 1918. And this text I'm going to read you was not taken out of textbooks until the early 60s. Definition of races of man. At the present time, there exists upon the earth 5 races and varieties of man. This is where our Christian children were going to school and reading. Each, and not just, quote unquote, the fair-skinned children, all the children. Each very different from each other in instincts, social custom, and to an extent in structure. These are the Ethiopian or Negro type, originating in Africa, the Malay or brown race from the islands of the Pacific, the American Indian, the Mongoloid or yellow race, including the natives of China, Japan, and the Eskimos. And finally, the, quote, highest type of all, the Caucasians, represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. And America. Supposedly a melting pot. This is why, people would say things like, you wonder why people would say things like, you can't date my daughter, or you can't date my sister. You wonder why? Because this tied to evolutionary thinking, there is an evolution among humans, and some are more evolved than others. It's very sad. So I'm just going to say this. Let's go to how we have absorbed the culture. We have a song, don't we? Jesus loves the little children, all the children, red and yellow, black and white, they are precious. And you may not, I understand the spirit behind that song is one of unity. And the spirit behind the creation of that song is exactly what Jesus prayed for in John 17. But the song itself is based on biological untruths. There is no red or yellow, black and white. And so I don't let my kids sing it. I'm not being ugly. I don't let my kids sing that song. I'll ask Bible class teachers not to sing it if they do. And my kids know. We just don't sing it. Excuse me. Let me say this. I'm going to go into this in a minute, but let me add this real quick. These are the people these colors are supposed to describe. And that's not who they are. Let me show you something. See my coat? My coat is black. If your skin is black, something's wrong. You're about to lose a toe or something. I'm serious. See my shirt? My shirt is white. Nobody has white skin, barring some aberration. And if you do, I mean, something's not normal. Either you're an albino or something like that, or something else is not right. And if the racial categories were legitimate, wouldn't we be able to look at somebody and know, quote unquote, what they are? I'm telling you right now, you know my reality? I grew up in Minnesota where I thought, I'm an idealistic person and I'm an activist at heart, and I thought racism was bad there. And racism exists. Even though the racial categories might not be legitimate, we're trained to recognize certain things. And so when you have the power in the politics, and then you're trained with the prejudice, and then you're responding to certain prejudices, it can get ugly. But then I moved to another part of the country, and I felt like I went back in time. I couldn't believe it. Let me tell you something. I get a look. I might get it a few times in my 21 years of living in Minnesota. But I got it more in my first week of being in Tampa than I did my whole life. And I went down there at 22 years old. And here's what happens. Even if it's a stranger, I know what's coming. Because I get the look. Here's the look. They're talking to you normally, but then all of a sudden they get... And then they'll say, "What are you?" So I say, "I'm good looking. That's what I am." "What are you?" But I say, no, you know what I mean. What's your race? And I say, "Human." They say, no, your nationality. I say, "I'm American." They say, and then one of two things will happen. Usually they'll say, "You can't be American. You got to have something in you." I'm not kidding you. This happens to me more than I can count. That phrase has even been said to me. He says he's American. You can't be American. Remember the white race, European and American. We have been trained to think that I'm not American because of how I look. Maybe you guys haven't been trained, but our culture to a large degree has been. And when people look at me, what happened, what I realized early on when I got to Tampa was there were a lot of people who needed to know how to categorize me. They needed to know what box to put me in. And I suspect it's because then they would know how to treat me. I knew a guy, and I'll show you what I mean. I knew a guy, he and I were working somewhere, he's a Christian guy, and there was this gorgeous young lady, her name was Sandy. Stunning. Like anybody would look at her and think, wow, maybe one of the prettiest people you ever saw in your life. Just not even from an attractive standpoint, but just from an objective standpoint. You just thought, wow, she's stunning. And he was like, "Oh man, she's gorgeous. I wonder if she is Puerto Rican or Italian." And they said, "I hope she's Italian." So I was like, "Why?" Because it mattered. What box she was in mattered to him. Even on a slight level. So I want to say, if they were legitimate, you ought to be able to look at me and know what I am. And I don't even tell people. I don't tell people because, and sometimes they'll say, "Oh, are you ashamed?" or this and that, try to badger me. I say, "I'm not ashamed of who I am by any means. However, this is my passive-aggressive way to stick it to people who are trying to categorize me, to force them to look at me the way God wants us to look at everybody." You see, when David was getting ready to be anointed king of Israel, and Samuel sees his older brother and says, "Oh, this guy's got to be it." This is 1 Samuel 16. And God says, He says, "See, I don't look at people the way you look at them. You guys look at the outside, I look at the heart. And if we look at people the way God does, we're not going to get caught up in trying to categorize people." Oh, well, I was just curious. I'm not saying there aren't people with good hearts that are simply curious about that stuff. But I am not going to sacrifice that and I will sacrifice their desire and telling them just so I can continue to force people. Because I recognize I have a unique look that people claim all over the place. Everybody assumed, most people assumed in Minnesota that I was biracial. Most people. Although some people would say, what are you? Because I can tell you're not black, but I got to know. I know something. And I'm something, right? They don't ask the white people around me, quote unquote white people, but they got to ask me. What does that mean? And then when I go to the South, when I go to Tampa, everybody assumes I'm Puerto Rican or Cuban. And that's a whole other assumption. But there's lots of different countries in South America people have claimed me for. Even all the, some of the island countries like Trinidad or Mexico, Hawaiian, I get that a lot. I get Persian. I get Lumbee Indian. That's Lumbee Indians are in North Carolina. And even the Lumbee Indians tell me, yeah, I thought you were a Lumbee Indian. You could go all through the Mideast Indian, or you can go through Portuguese or parts. It doesn't, all over. And the obscure places I never even heard of that people claim me from. They claim me. You're one of me. I can tell. I just go, that may be not be honest, but I used to do that all the time. Because I just figure if they say it, they believe it, all that really matters is what they think anyway. In their mind. So I do this. So now I'm going to tell you why these colors, why I say from a biblical standpoint, these colors that we sing about are dangerous to use. Why in the 60s, or in the civil rights movement, there were people like Malcolm X who would say things like, strong coffee is black coffee. He even has a famous quote where he says this. Listen to this. He's talking to some people and he says, it's like when you've got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. He says, so what do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. He said, you put enough cream, you won't even ever know you had coffee. It was strong, it becomes weak. It was hot, it becomes cool. It used to wake you up, and now it'll put you to sleep. And his crowd was going, ah, yeah! Why? Because he was responding to what he believed was a white man's religion of Christianity, and he was training people to think differently about the racial categories. Good guys, there was a rap group I used to listen to when I was a kid that said, good guys wear white, bad guys wear black. Must have been a white guy who started all that. Well, was it? Let me tell you why it's dangerous to use these colors. And I say dangerous. Because these colors have definitions that are given by God. And we are taking colors that don't even apply to us. And we're using them to describe people. You want to know what the definitions of these colors are in the Bible? And you look at this and you tell me how you could ever be confused about how people could think Christianity is a white man's religion. And why we're talking about white privilege. Because these definitions are given by God. Red, sinful, Isaiah 1:18. Death, Revelation 6:4. War, Nahum 2 verse 3. It's associated with Satan, Revelation 12 verse 3. Temptation, Genesis 25:30, Proverbs 23:31. That's red. You want to be red? If you're a Christian and you know what these words mean? Black. God's eternal judgment, Jude 1 verses 12 and 13. Disease, Job 30:30. Famine, Revelation 6 verses 5 and 6. Poverty and death, Lamentations 4 verses 8 and 9. God's wrath, Revelation 6 verses 11 and 13. Sin, Job 6 verse 15 and 16. Do you want to be categorized as black? If you're, and you see this? White is purity, Psalm 51 verse 7. Cleanliness, Psalm 51 verse 7. Sinless, Isaiah 1 verse 18. Victory, Revelation 6 verses 1 through 3. Joy, Ecclesiastes 9 verse 8. Righteous and heavenly, Matthew 7 verse 2, John 20 verse 12, Revelation 3 verse 4 and 5 and 18, chapter 4 verse 4, chapter 6 verse 11, and chapter 7 verse 9 of Revelation. This is what we are seeing in the Bible. And what happens when we take these colors that have definitions given by God and use them as labels to describe people? You think about this when I preach tomorrow about the Gideon factor and the power of labels. Let me show you something with science. There are two forms of melanin, but melanin pretty much is the same thing. There's two forms of it though. One will make your skin real dark brown or real dark. One will make your skin more fair. And let me show you how this works. Again, this chart is kind of a simplification, but I want you to think about the lowercase letter representing the one form of melanin that makes your skin fair. The uppercase letter being the form of melanin that makes your skin dark. And so when you have people who only have those uppercase letters, they marry somebody who has uppercase letters, their children are going to have dark skin. That's the way it works. Same thing as if you have the same thing there. However, in the middle, you have what we call, like my complexion, maybe what you might call middle brown. You see upper and lowercase letters. And you have about 13% of the human population that has the capacity to pass on all the characteristics. When we look at science and what the Human Genome Project proved to everybody, and everybody who studies it comes home telling their mom and dad, "Mom, Dad, did you know there's no races? There's no such thing as race." Because the Human Genome Project proved that every human being came from one man and one woman. My stepmom was wrong. But the Bible was right. And we are ignoring it in favor of a racist guy who hated God, Charles Darwin. Whose book title had to be redacted just so it could be accepted in today's society. The preservation of favored races. So what we learn from science, see, here's what I want to say. Evolution did not create the races. What is evolution as we understand it? It is when over time there is a new genetic construct introduced into the gene pool. There's macro and microevolution. Macro is when we get a whole new species. No one has seen that ever. No, there's been no evidence of that. Microevolution we've witnessed. In insects and such, where beings might have children and they reproduce and there is an evolution in the species, new genetic information being introduced. We don't see that in human beings. We don't see it there. And here, this is why it's so important, because a lot of Christians will say microevolution is what created the races. And it's not. And it's dangerous to say that. And I'll tell you why. Because science has proven that Adam and Eve were middle brown. Because if you take a couple that's middle brown and they have capacity up for uppercase and lowercase melanin for both sides in one generation, meaning with not going any farther in depth than their children, depending on how many they have, you can have fair skin and blonde hair, blue eyes, straight hair. You can have dark skin, curly hair. And then see, the racial categories are astounded when they go to Australia and they see people darker than anybody in this room with limp blonde hair and crystal blue eyes. Where did they come from? Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. Because this is why it's different than evolution. Because all the genetic information was already there. And it becomes more narrow. Now let me show you something. You know how many atoms there are in the universe? You want to take a guess? That's how many. 1 to the 72nd power. You know how many electrons there are in the universe? That's how many. 1 to the 236th power. You know how many children of genetic variation two people can have? That's how many. 1 to the 2076th power. That's something to shoot for, isn't it? But let me tell you, that's not how many people. That's one time. That's how many people you could have is what I mean. That many people, a lot. With two people, two individuals. But we argue about race all the time. February 13th, 1995, Newsweek had a cover, and they devoted the whole magazine to race. And you know what the cover was? It was called, "What Color is Black?" You see, the anthropologists have been successful, the geneticists have been successful, and race is no longer being categorized as a genetic thing. Among the masses who don't know better, they still say things like, people are just different. But when I went to college, I thought to myself, well, this is interesting. My sociology textbook is promoting race because the psychologists still want the categories. Did you know that? The social scientists still want the categories. So in sociology, they'll say, yeah, race is a social cultural construct. It's cultural. It's not genetic. Why do we still need the categories? Power and politics? Because we have political organizations that are lobbying the government whose whole identity is based on these racial categories that were created hundreds of years ago. And they get money from the government. A lot. So they lose their jobs, they lose their influence if they step away from all the power they have piggybacking off these racial ideas when they're bogus. And then prejudice. Now that the ball's been running, we've let the cat out of the bag. How are you going to get it back? You can't unring the bell. So there are people who have legitimate prejudice and racism toward other people because of these racial constructs. How can you out-teach race, or how can you teach racism out of somebody or prejudice out of somebody? It's a heart change, and it comes back to the gospel. It comes back to the gospel. Let me show you this. To show you how people can have children that look different. See these two babies? They're twins. Not albino. It's not an albino. That baby has fair skin and blue eyes. And they are brothers. If race is a legitimate concept, what race are they? It doesn't end. See those two kids? They're twins. Blonde hair, straight hair, blue eyes. Their parents, middle brown. Remember? I told you the middle brown people can have a variety of children in terms of how they look. Some of them can. Some of them. Not all of them. Twins. What race are they? And even these babies, not an albino. It even has a curly hair, but it's blonde. This happened in Nigeria. Wavy, curly hair, same features, blonde hair, blonde, blue eyes, and not an albino. The story, doctor was being interviewed, and after the baby was born, so the dad just sat there like this. But he said, the baby looked like my other kids when they were born, just fair-skinned. That happened twice in the same family. And he'll show you about their parents. Their parents, one of them is middle brown, one of them is fair-skinned. It's really interesting. You know, I'll put some pictures of my kids in this deal. I should have done that. My first child was born with jet black hair and blue eyes. But the hair fell out after a month, and it grew back bleach blonde. My wife's hair is medium dark brown, and she has brown eyes. Well, let me tell you what would happen to us all the time. Evidently, some of you might know this, evidently, blue eyes is a desirable characteristic for some people. And some people didn't like the fact that I had a blue-eyed baby. These are my friends that would tell me. They'd look at my baby, and I could tell when they were doing it because they'd always look at her, and they'd look at me for a second, then go to Heather, my wife, and look, you don't have blue eyes? And little did they know, one of my eyes is blue. But people look at me and sometimes assume my eyes are black and all kinds, you know, sometimes the label glazes and hazes the way we really see people. So, then people would, this happened to us about 4 or 5 times. Good friends of ours who would say, look at me and say, how come you get a kid with blue eyes? I'm thinking, where is this coming from? And then most often they all look at her. People even wouldn't say what I just said before, but a lot of times they look at her and say, huh, they'll change. They'll change. She was 3, 4, 5 years old. They're still saying, they'll change. But they haven't. They're still blue. And her hair's gotten darker, but she's pretty fair-skinned, darker than my wife, but she still has blue eyes. And she looks just like me, but she's fair-skinned. And here's what's interesting. My next child was darker. My third child, my son Malachi, is darker than me. My wife's fair-skinned. He's darker than me. And people tell me that he looks just like me. Oh, he looks just like you. And I know how they're seeing him. They're seeing his skin. Because he doesn't look just like me, at least in terms of features. My two fairest kids actually look just like me, but they just don't have dark skin or curly hair. And so it's interesting. You can tell how people see things by how they talk. But this question brings us back. I want to say, sometimes people will say, well, how come all the people in China look the same? Well, they don't, but I know what you're talking about. And so I got to ask you, is there anything that ever has happened that has separated the people so they could isolate their gene pool? Yeah, it's what we talked about last night. It's Tower of Babel. When God separated the people into roughly 78 people groups, when anthropologists trace back the linguistic origins of what we have today, they trace it back to roughly 78 original languages. Go figure. The Bible was right all along. And when you separate, and people can only interact with people who they know and they can communicate with, eventually their gene pool becomes more narrow. And you had this wide gene pool in Adam and Eve, but it got separated because of the curse of the languages that God put on them in Genesis chapter 11. That's how we have people that look so different. And that's why people in China don't often have that other different looking child. Although, it happens a lot more than you might think. So here's what we have. Satan is having a field day. Because we're buying the hype and believing the hype and buying all the propaganda that we are much more different at our core than God made us. And when he does that, he doesn't have to get us to say Jesus Christ is a liar, we can't be one. But the outcome of believing the lie that we're all different in races means we have an immediate barrier to be doing what Jesus said and becoming one. And we might not believe Jesus quite as much as we did before. And with every lie Satan does, he picks away at Jesus a little bit more. Power and politics. You look at all the racial trouble we have in America, and you think to yourself, is there anybody who can make some money from this? Is there anybody who can get some political power from this? How is this being talked about? And you might have your answer to why the fans are being flamed. Prejudice. Is prejudice being involved here somehow? And it'll answer the question. And then you got to ask yourself, how would Satan feel about this? And if he's being glorified, it shows us exactly what Jesus said. He is the prince of this world. But Jesus has authority over heaven and earth, Matthew 28, 18 through 20 says. All authority. Let's submit to him. And let's not believe the hype when people push this stuff, because the Bible was right all along. We do come from one man and one woman. And science now is showing it, so it's in vogue to say it. Well, we can't control the past, and I can't control anybody else but me. So what do? I believe God, and I try to look at people the way God does. See, Isaiah 55, verse 9 and 10 says, his ways are higher than our ways, his thoughts are higher than our thoughts. I try to think that way. I believe God when he says in Genesis 3:20, Eve is the mother of all living. I believe God when he says in Acts 17:26, that from one blood he made all the nations. I believe God when he said in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 45, Adam is the first man. And I also do try and do my passive-aggressive sticking it to people to force them to look at me the way God wants them to look at me. Which is why I never answer the question. And people make assumptions, and I don't care. Would it be fun to talk about? I would love to. Sometimes people could tell certain things in that, but I just don't. I'm more committed to the agenda of Christ than anything else. And if that means me sacrificing talking about anything about my background, then so be it. Because not everybody looks like me. And not everybody gets claimed by all these different ethnic groups. So I just roll with it and use it because that's the hand I was dealt. But whoever you are, you can look at people the way God looks at them too. And we can be one. Just like it said in Galatians 3, 27 and 28. By being baptized into Christ and by loving each other with that perfect bond of unity, which is love. We ought never to say he's a black preacher. We ought never to talk about black churches. We ought never to say things like, well, they can't get married or you can't date my daughter. That's not biblical talk. The people we ought to be concerned about them marrying are the people who can best help them get to heaven, no matter what they look like. Because ultimately, I'll tell you something about that. If any of you are struggling with that or know somebody who is, think about what Jesus said at the beginning of Matthew chapter 7. That how we judge other people is going to affect our judgment. So what that means is, if we're not going to let somebody be a part of our family because of a God-given inconsequentiality, like the color of their skin, then what's going to stop God from keeping us out of his family? How we judge other people is going to affect our judgment. We've got to be adamant about God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven. And no matter who we are as individuals, every single individual on earth is made in God's image, and God wants to give them his glory in the oneness of Christ. Satan's fighting it. All the political people are fighting it. All the prejudiced people are slow to get it. Let's help them. Let's show them that we can be one. And let's show them that Jesus Christ sees everybody as being potentially a part of his family and desirable. Everybody is desirable by God. If you want to be baptized into Christ and be one in Christ, why don't you come forward while we stand and sing?